morning. Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. The purpose of the United Lodge of Theosophists is to keep before the public the original writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge, who brought to the attention of the world, once again, those ageless, eternal teachings that had been passed down from one generation of wise human beings to another. Theosophy, in that sense, represents the accumulated wisdom of the ages. It is the property of no particular person, race, or civilization, but represents the accumulated wisdom of the investigation, scientific and otherwise, into every department of nature. The most important aspects for us to understand together are the basic fundamental ideas of the teachings of Theosophy as they become a very practical basis in the ethical as well as practical conduct of our lives. And the most important thing we can gain from these fundamental teachings is a truer realization of the self, our essential identity, its significance, what it means, and a truer conviction that universal brotherhood, interdependence, interrelationship is a fact in nature. Because the sooner we understand that law and live in harmony with it, the sooner our own lives will be brought into balance as well as those around us. So in order to keep these ideas before the public, we here in Philadelphia have a few weekly meetings and services. In the front of the building, there is a library, which is open from 5:30 till 7:30 on Wednesday evenings, just before the Wednesday evening class. It's a reference library, and there is always a student available to help you in your individual investigation and research. Theosophy encourages individual research. No one is expected to accept blindly what is put out, but rather each is encouraged to test, check, and verify for themselves these ideas, put them in the test, to the test, and see their value in their lives. So that library is available. It's not a lending library, and there is a student there to direct you to the material to be studied for the evenings, any references, or any other material you might be interested in reference to Theosophy or the arts and sciences, history, philosophy in general. In the center of the building, on the first floor here, we have a book table for the same purpose, individual study, an opportunity to check for oneself into the straight-line original teachings of Theosophy. And we use that, we make that point only because through the years, of course, individuals, students, and otherwise have done their best to try and interpret and explain the teachings, and that's fine as it goes, but it's important to be able to compare what is being said with the original teachings as put forward. So that's why we here at the United Lodge of Theosophists always make available to students and visitors alike the opportunity to check, test, and verify those original teachings for themselves, without having to depend on others to do it. So, in addition to the service provided by the library, these books and magazines and other reference materials are available at cost. There's no profit to be made. The only charge is made for their production and shipment. And of course, they're all available in the library anyway. But if one wants to purchase them and take them home for individual study, they are available. The library, the book table hours are before and after meetings and during library hours. Now, as to our meetings during the summer, we've been having two weekly meetings. On Wednesday evening, we have a study class in the Bhagavad Gita, and that is from 7:45 to 9 p.m. Well, why do we study the Bhagavad Gita? Because within it are found those practical, ethical, philosophical, and psychological principles we find in all great philosophies and religions, but also for the understanding of the human condition, the problems we have and within ourselves and with others. Once we try to pursue a path of devotion, the Bhagavad Gita is exemplary in its ability to lay out the situation and the step-by-step process by which we are to make progress in those conditions. So through the years, whether we've studied it once or many times, it always is a spring of new insight and practical application. So this Wednesday, the subject is the renunciation of self-interest. And then on Sunday mornings, we've been studying a series of articles, the individuality and personality. And as we said before, these articles are the product of an individual student's research. Now, we do not know who this student is. It's not really important their name or who they were, but they were published many years ago as a series of articles in Magazine Theosophy. And through the years, students have found them particularly helpful in understanding this whole range, all the different aspects of this issue of individuality and personality. And that's part of understanding the real nature of the self, to understand that there's a part of ourselves which is temporary, illusionary, but is an important tool in everyday life. And there's a part of ourselves, the basis of our individuality, which is permanent, enduring, and is not affected by the temporary conditions around us. So understanding the contrast of those two aspects of our nature is very important in gaining self-knowledge, but also knowledge of the world we live in. So this, we've been studying this series of articles on Sunday mornings from 11 to 12. And this week we are looking into the subject of the mystery of individuality, which we'll get to in a moment. But the whole point of this is to bring home the idea that all the work here is sustained by voluntary efforts of time, service, and money. No one is imposed upon, there is no obligation implied, but rather as the ideas are presented, individuals are left free to choose to the extent it inspires and helps them in their lives. If they wish to partake more, attend more, help out more in the practical promulgation of the work, which obviously involves keeping these buildings open and running and constant availability of volunteer students who will present the part. So, this morning, then, for those of you who have the handout, you'll see that the subject is from one of the articles in the series of The Mystery of Individuality called The Approach to Self-Consciousness. And one of the primary fundamental ideas in theosophy is that of evolution. Not just that we evolve physically, there's a transition of form, but also there is a transition, an evolution of the consciousness within the form. So at some point, we might say, as human forms or beings, there is a mindlessness. And then at another point, there is a definite presence of self-consciousness, the feeling of I am I, the feeling of individuality. And that feeling, that awareness of oneself as an individual observing being, is a process of evolution. And so this morning we are going to look into that process of the transition from one stage to another, how it occurs in nature and in ourselves. So this morning we will have this part summarized, and we might just mention that the student who had volunteered to give this part is ill and unable to present it, so one of our other students at the last minute volunteered to come forth and do their best in summarizing the part.
We have no microphone, but our voice is loud and strong. The evolutionary process itself, just to give a brief background, is explained in seven rounds of experience and learning. So when it talks about going from planetary chains and going through rounds, the part mentions specific periods of evolution within a great cycle. And as was said, we're looking at the point from which the consciousness has gotten all the learning possible up to a certain point, and then mind is lit up, and that self-consciousness, as was mentioned, the I am I, the recognition of self, is possible in the human stage. So the question is made, how does that happen? When does that happen? How is it possible? Who assists in this process? And we start with the idea that the higher animal life now in our evolutionary period has 3.5 more rounds left to achieve self-consciousness. We're talking about the animal life that has achieved all that it can through all the stages of the lower kingdoms. But it also says lower in the part that the door has been closed for that to happen. So the mystery remains, what now? And it tells us that many, many transformations will take place. And by the close of the seventh round, which is quite a while from now, men will become gods in self-consciousness. The self-awareness will be complete, blended, a oneness. There won't be any separation of mind, matter, ideas. It will be a oneness. So we say the human will become God in self-consciousness. And the animals will become intelligent beings, but not reach fully that state of awakened human consciousness, that self-consciousness. And it gives us the process by which all of this occurs in the sense of form. We know from prior classes that the monad, or the unit of intelligence, the consciousness, not self-consciousness, but pure universal consciousness, is moving through the lower kingdoms. Well, where do the forms come from? It gives us an idea that as each kingdom proceeds, the forms are left behind for the next wave of beings coming through evolution. Same with the human kingdom, that the human forms will be left behind for the period when those higher animals are ready for the change, but sort of run out of time, in a sense. And then it goes through, there are great changes in store for the present higher animal. And there's a quote there from Mr. Judge. And it tells us that any monads who had not reached the human stage until the close of the seventh round will be the humanity of a future period of evolution. Well, that makes sense to us. If they've done all the work and are ready for this next progression as the cycle closes, the end of the seventh round is the return to spirit and then a period of rest. When the next cycle comes forth, they are ready for the stage of human conscious self-consciousness, and they will be the ones that take up that stream at that time. And it says that for waiting, because they didn't have the opportunity to fulfill that here in this period, their karmic compensation is that that life will be in a higher chain of development. Because we know each time the evolutionary cycle rolls forward, it's in a higher period of development. Because we've learned all that can be learned where we are now, we need higher knowledge and higher self-consciousness, self-awareness. So, in the new period then, in the next period, the builders of the human form are these human elementals who had reached the human form in the preceding seventh round. They were fully equipped to repeat their previous accomplishment. And these are called the lunar Petries. You might hear that term come up during classes. They include all the lives used by humans in the previous evolutionary period and not yet elevated to the plane of the thinker. And one of the statements made on the second page we think is very telling. The first full paragraph, there, a statement from the secret doctrine is especially pertinent to this discussion. The monads which had not reached the human stage will, owing to the evolution of humanity itself, find themselves so far behind that they will reach the human stage only at the close of the seventh and last round. So it is telling us this evolution is interblended at all points, that as we act, we have an effect on all the kingdoms and so forth among them. We are self-consciously acting, however, and have a responsibility in that sense. So, we're gonna leave the last bit for questions.
Okay. Did you want to? Okay.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. When we're presented with teachings from the philosophy such as this that pertain to the history of the development of forms in the different kingdoms way back in the early history of this planet, or said to will occur in the far distant future, we wonder, well, how is it possible that we can check, test, and verify this? What measurements, what instruments can we use, not having the benefit of those records or that insight or the accumulated experience through the ages of witnessing these things going on? And if we remember that basic idea of as above, so below, that as human beings, we not only have contact with all the different departments of nature, we are interblended, but they are all represented in us. We are mirrors of the larger universe. We are, the expression is, we are microcosms of the macrocosms. So if we look within and examine ourselves physically, mentally, emotionally, morally, spiritually, and all the different departments of our beings, we see analogies and correspondences. And factually, the only way we can understand and prove to ourselves these ideas is through direct self-conscious experience. So in our stage of development, we have to continuously look not only at the reasonableness, the logical aspects of the teachings, but also to what extent we see them operating now in our own nature and in our own experience. So there was a question in the back, yes.
On the second page, and it was read during the summary, the next to the last sentence, they will therefore not be men on this chain term the unnamed terror. Is that sentence referring to the luminal features?
So the question relates to that statement in the second paragraph on page 2. Speaking of the monadic wave in the animal kingdom, which because the time will have run out for evolution on this planetary chain, will not reach the point where it can make that transition, that lighting up into self-consciousness or the feeling of I am I, which is characteristic of the human mind and experience. So they will have that self-conscious experience in a human type form, whatever might it would be, in the next great cycle or the next planetary chain after this Earth we understand dissolves or disintegrates, obviously in the far distant future. So the name given in the ancient Hindu teachings for these intelligences that experience and direct the development of the form, the human form nature, we might say that they're the craftsmen, the builders, the generators of the human form are the Petries. And they're given the name Lunar Petries in the teachings because the previous period of evolution, the previous chain of globes on which humanity evolved was on that body in the heavens we call the moon being the dying remnant of a previous chain. And when it died out, and its principles were transferred to a new center, which became our Earth as we know it, the life wave of intelligences working through all those kingdoms reincarnated or incarnated on this Earth's plane of development and began their evolutionary progress. So the lunar Petries then represent that monadic wave and its different degrees of development that will go from this period of evolution into the next one. And as it says at the bottom, these seven classes of lunar fathers or Petries, the word is in Sanskrit, or human progenitors will be brought up more in the next two articles of this series. Yes?
Okay, so in this area that what you're speaking, are we talking about the different planes of evolution, like the spiritual, the psychic, the physical? Because we're trying to understand the thinker entering on the scene. Does the thinker entering on the scene of this whole evolution bring about this idea of from the mindless to the self-consciousness?
Mm-hmm. Well, the basic question here is how is the we begin to understand when this occurred, this transition from the mindless state in the human animal form to the mindful state or the self-conscious state. When did it first occur on this planet we call the Earth? We said it first occurred in this planetary chain 18 million years ago. It will not reach its complete stage for all the intelligences in the lower animal kingdom to be ready to make that transition until the final periods of evolution on this planet. But because there will be no time for further evolution, no attempt is made to waken it up. Who does the waking up? Who wakes up the intelligences evolving in those lower animal forms? We might say it's those who became self-consciously human in the previous period of evolution. So we might say that we are self-conscious. We will also be evolving, and it is said that at the end of our great period of evolution, the forms and the intelligence and the powers that we have and the material work do will be so much greater than what we are using now that we will be as gods. So as the new planetary scene of evolution comes forth, we will be the teachers, the enlighteners, those that light up the mind in those forms. It's sort of the same way which goes on with a parent working with their children or a teacher working with the classroom. The teacher has gone not only through all the grades of the school, but then goes through a specific training how to teach and a specific certification how to teach, and even is specialized in certain degrees of that education, comes back and awakens in the student the knowledge and it's necessary for that stage. Now, the teacher does not teach college algebra to the third grade, although we understand it's getting closer to that. So intelligent, there's an interesting observation. It seems to us that the intelligence, the quickness of mind in grasping all sorts of world affairs and ethical concerns and technological affairs in the average second or third grader is so much more than we recall our classmates when we were in those elementary classes. We know there's a popular TV show now called Are You As Smart As a Fifth Grader? And it's amazing the intelligence and the recall that these young students have. We're not talking about the elite, but just the average student. Does that not show that even within our period of evolution that we see in a small time frame, there's a bringing forth of greater awareness and intelligence, an ever-evolving process? Well, who does this? It's the result of the interaction of the generation that went before. We add to them, their intelligence, all our experience and light it up. We enhance, we bring forth the further evolution of those that came behind. And we might say that the students coming into the education now have a great advantage because they are the inheritors of an educational system that has the benefits of the technology and all the experience of those that went before them. In the same way, those that are coming through the animal kingdom, we might say, and not get to the human stage until the end of this round, will have the benefits in the previous evolution, not only of higher conditions, but all the experience of those that went before them. Yes?
In the first paragraph it says, was it made 18 million years ago at the time of the lighting up of mind? Now, 18 million years ago, from what I've read, is the separation of the sexes. But wasn't mind already lit up? I asked this because there was a statement one night, and it was about the ancient kings of Edom. And when I looked it up, it said before the sexes were separated, these were wise rulers, and went on to give some, you know, small detail. So in order to be a ruler, in order to be a king, in order to be wise, wouldn't you have to have the lighting up?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting, the symbolism there, and it's one for individual research. We're just going to put out the general idea with the encouragement that each one check it out for themselves. But in the Bible, when there's reference to the various patriarchs and the whole chapter of so-and-so begatting so-and-so, and reference to individuals like Methuselah and Seth and Enoch, and then, of course, in other books, other wise men, it's referring to previous races of humanity prior to the waking up of self-conscious awareness. So we say that took place in the third root race 18 million years ago. But obviously there have been a previous long period of evolution, we might say the first and second root races, where there was still intelligence there and power and form working, but it was more of a spiritual, highly spiritual nature and did not have the direct individualized self-consciousness working through it. We might say that it was an intuitive, automatic spirituality inherent in the form rather than a self-consciousness that directly chose good and evil, right and wrong, and understood the difference. It was a different stage. It's almost like as a child grows up, when we are children, we are naturally trusting, naturally devoted to our parents, believe everything our teachers tell us. We're pure at heart. We care for animals and insects, and we're naturally, almost intuitively, spiritual. What happens is we grow older, we get a little more experience, maybe we're hurt, maybe we see contrast, we lose some of that innocence, become a little more skeptical, a little more critical in our in our evaluation of others, not taking things so quickly, using more judgment. But then, as we grow older, we try to regain that childlike state. We try to return to that place of compassion and understanding and charity with all the experience we gained, in spite of all the experience gained. So as Jesus said, we become as wise as serpents, but as harmless as doves. So that sort of parallels these earlier racial developments there. There was no individualized self-consciousness, but a very pure state of spiritual consciousness before the fall of man into greater degrees of materiality of form and consciousness. Yes?
The first full paragraph on the second page, the statement in the sacred doctrine that says about the monads that had not reached the human stage will, owing to the evolution of humanity itself, find themselves so far behind that they will reach the human stage only to close the last round.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is, the next statement is, they will therefore not be bent on this chain, but will form the humanity of a future Manvantara and be rewarded by becoming men on a higher chain altogether, thus receiving their karmic compensation. Well, it seems unfair because they're not self-consciously suffering. Although they may be conscious, they're not really, they don't have the anxieties and frustrations and angst, for lack of a better word, that we're going through right now. And they're going to skip over and end up with a higher. It's almost like, seems more desirable to be at the lower stage right now.
Well,
so we can leapfrog over this.
Well, you know, we may enjoy our hot childhood, but looking back, how many of us would like to spend the rest of our lives there? Even on our worst days, we may look back and think, oh, it'd be nice to be able to sleep late and, you know, nothing but, you know, play with our friends and so forth. But then we look at the advantages of getting experience and growing and developing relationships and all things that go with it. That's the expression about, for everything there is a time, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for peace, a time for war. So in this process of evolution, there's a time for childhood and innocence, and there's a time for gaining knowledge and experience. And there's a time to take that all and regenerate ourselves as complete beings. So the problem is that if you've gone through the work, you've made the progress, and within all the kingdom there's that indwelling monad pushing forth, and you don't have the benefit of the fruit of that experience because the time has run out, or there's nobody there to teach you, there has to be some compensation. So you get up in the morning and you know you have to catch a train, and you get yourself all prepared to go, and you know, and you're on the way, and you get caught on a jam on the Schuylkill Expressway, and you miss the train. Well, we did everything we were supposed to. It wasn't our fault, per se, that we didn't make the train or didn't get there in time. We expect there to be some type of justice or compensation. We don't feel it's right. It's the same thing. There's a natural law or balance in nature. As evolution is moving forward, if there's no more time for evolution in a particular period of evolution because the physical means the earth has worn out, or there are the intelligences evolving there no longer have time to teach, it's the end of the school year, and it's too late for Johnny to be taught or Mary to be taught because the school year is over. They're going to have to wait for summer school or next year to catch up. If the time has run out, then under this law of karma, those intelligences have the opportunity to have the advantage of the human experience at a time when the human condition will be a much higher one. But the same is true for us, because the work we have done, we will also be in that same human condition. We will be able to work, provide opportunities, help others in conditions that are much more favorable to our desires than they are now. So all will benefit, not just the lower, but the higher degrees of human awareness as well.
Is there a clue, though, in the sentence, they had not reached the human stage owing to the evolution of humanity itself? Is that a clue towards the fact that they were held back, in a sense, because we didn't do what we were here to do, so we had to keep coming back to work out our karmic lessons, which had an effect on their progress?
Well, it's partially true, but once self-consciousness is achieved, then our evolution is in our own hands. We are no longer operating at the natural impulse of nature. So what might take possible over millions of years can be accomplished not only in our mental and moral and spiritual development, but in our physical development as well, in a relatively few lifetimes, because of the determined will and sustained effort of the self-conscious thinker. Now, the individuals who have done that, we call them perfected human beings. And in the philosophy, there are given examples of individual human beings such as Buddha, Krishna, Jesus, who, because of their individual effort, represent and have accomplished psychologically, morally, spiritually, and physically for themselves what general humanity on the average will have accomplished in the sixth round of evolution. Now, we're not even at the seventh round, but the sixth round. And Jesus himself said, that whatever I have done, you can do even greater than I, acknowledging that there is a possibility of evolution even before, far beyond what he had achieved. So this sixth rounder represents that state. But at some point, all of humanity will represent that stage. So the human form will be, and constitution will be so far advanced that those coming up will not possibly be able to use it. So think of the student that's truant, you know, and doesn't do their homework. And it's the first quarter, and the teachers let them slide, and it's the second quarter, and now the social workers and the psychologists are brought in, and the third quarter, the parents are getting frustrated. And finally, you know, in the fourth quarter, you know, I learned my lesson, they're going to try. But they're ready to try to understand what their classmates have been working and masturbating for 3 years. They're at the beginning of the textbook, and the rest of the class is, finishing up the last chapter. There's no way they can catch up. So it's the same way. Even though they may make the effort to enter the race, so to speak, enter that phase of self-consciousness, they cannot possibly master and use the form of the human condition at that time. They have to work through lower animal human conditions. And it's interesting, what it says is the animal forms we know, even the higher ones of the ape and the gorilla and chimpanzee, will be extinct by then, that there will be animal forms, vegetable forms, mineral forms that are so much more evolved and developed than they are now, and give even greater opportunity for the experiences of the intelligences in them, but it still won't be human experience. There'll be a higher degree of animal experience.
So then, taking that group and the group that has finished the work, they both arrive at the next evolutionary chain.
Yes.
They're higher because the chain is higher, but isn't the group that finished the textbook on time better prepared? So the karmic balance there is that those who arrive sort of along with the rest of them get the benefit of arriving at a higher stage, but haven't had the opportunity to have any of those muscles built in
yes.
the sense that the other group did have time to do the work.
Okay. That's right. So, but let's say, so the example is, even if they could arrive, they wouldn't have had the benefit to develop the muscles. So let's give you an example of that and then transfer it to the teachings. So let's say that the family and the student exert a lot of pressure on the school board and all that. And they're given the opportunity to try to compete anyway, and they go to summer school and all that. But you know, the next year rolls around and it's clear that in spite of what was done, it's the same problem, or they still can't catch up. And yet they're there. They make it through, and they might even graduate. And we all know the problems. Okay, we hear about it and read about it all the time. But that has happened in the history of human form. Because there's one exception to that, this rule we've laid out, or the philosophies we've laid out, about no more human monads entering in the human kingdom. And the one exception to the rule is the anthropoid ape. Now remember, there have been monads developing up in the animal kingdom to the point where they are at the point of self-conscious development. But they have to stay in that kingdom, they can, until the end. At a certain period of evolution, in the fourth race, there was an interbreeding of human and a higher type of animal. And the offspring of that interblending was the anthropoid ape. And because it was partially human and partially animal, it did provide the opportunity for certain ones of those human monads developing in the lower kingdoms that couldn't get in to get in. So we have, it is the only exception in the animal kingdom, the higher animal kingdoms of the gorilla, the orangutan, and the chimpanzee, of human ego, self-conscious human ego or monad evolving in a lower animal form. And all we have, but because they have not developed the muscles, they got in prematurely. They weren't supposed to get in till the next period of evolution. They're not as strong. They cannot deal with the animal nature as it develops. So in all these lower, all these higher apes, the gorilla, the orangutan, the chimpanzee, when they're very young, they, because of the presence of the human intelligence, they show a lot of similarity. They can develop speech and use of language and tools. They can be faster learners than the other human children. But as the years go on, the chimpanzee or the gorilla, their animal nature takes over this self-consciousness more and more, and they become more animalistic, that human quality being drowned out. As the human develops, because they have the inner muscles, so to speak, they learn more and more to overcome and conquer and control the animal part of the nature. Which is a very valuable thing, but they control it rather than it controlling them. So That is, so the chimpanzee, the gorilla, and the orangutan are the called the delayed race, and as it is indicated in the teachings in connection with this part, by the end of the seventh root race in this fourth round, these forms will be extinct, and those egos caught in those forms, those human egos, will enter the human stage in the fifth round. So that will be their compensation. So we point that out because there is the general rule, but there is also the exception to every rule, just like in life. We have our general rules, and then under certain mitigating circumstances, there's an exception. Yes?
Can you make some characteristics, perhaps, that can distinguish animal from human life?
Well, can we name some distinguishing characteristics between the animal and human life or nature? We all should be able to do this because we are a blend of the human and the animal. And as we consider it, don't just look at it from the physical point of view, but look at it from a psychological, moral, passionate, and spiritual perspective. What distinctions do you, understanding your own nature, do you, and nature around you, do you see between the human and the animal condition? Yes.
The use of will in choosing right or wrong.
Now, animals use will. Animals use will. But using it in a right and wrong moral, weighing the ethics of the situation, all the possible outcomes, whether it's for me or for others, is a distinctive quality of the human being. We might say that when a colony of ants builds its ant farm, or when a pack of wolves hunt their prey, they are using will for the accomplishment of their purpose. But a pack of wolves cannot decide that they're going to stop hunting the prey and carry it to a place where it can be healed and feed for itself, and they cannot change their collective willful behavior. It is innate in their intelligence. But a human being, a group of human beings, can. The other example of difference between will in the human and in the animal kingdom is the individuality of will. If we have 20 people in this room, when we leave here, we all have 20 different possibilities of what we're going to do with the rest of our day based on our own will. In the lower kingdoms, that will is more predictable, confined to the species, and easy to determine and predict. It's sort of, people can understand animal and human animal behavior and expression of will. Human behavior is much more unpredictable when it comes to the individual expression of what's will, what one will do in any particular circumstance at any one time. We have that possibility because of our ability to choose at any one time how we will use that will. Any other differences you see? Yeah.
Well, it seems that human beings are capable, for a whole bunch of reasons you're just describing, of doing far greater evil than any other species that we know. Listening to a program on radio recently, somebody said, the only other known species in nature that does organized warfare or something similar to what human beings are famous for throughout history is ants. Yet ants did not have the necessity to develop the capacity to make complicated ethical decisions. So at some point in the process of evolving culture, society, and civilization, man became capable of doing terrible, terrible things that we don't see elsewhere in nature. But the point is just a more of a contribution. The question is, mothers the necessity of invention that man found himself doing these terrible things that motivated him to then evolve the psychological ability to distinguish between bad, wrong, and right.
Mm-hmm. So the point is made that because of our capacity as human beings for free will and self-conscious choice and moral determinations, we can be a lot more, quote, evil and destructive than any animal. An animal is acting for survival in congruence with its instincts and needs, whereas the human being can perpetuate harmful activity through no necessity or basic need for itself, but purely for the enjoyment to subdue and conquer and take advantage and raise oneself above another, take what somebody else has against what's not lawful. And we can manipulate things to our to that end. So we are capable of much more evil than the animal kingdom. But also, as the point was made, because of that self-conscious use of will, we also, even in the depths of that, have the ability to regenerate, reform the way we act, which is not seen in the lower kingdoms. Yes?
But then the next subject should be a discussion of the term savior of mankind who come periodically.
Mm. Yes. We'll bring that up. We did want to bring up, we had a point that was brought up by the previous contribution, sort of skipped our mind for a while, but to give you an example, the philosophy gives a few examples where in our current period of evolution, there are a few species of animals where that point of individual self-consciousness has almost been achieved to the highest degree, not quite yet human, and represents the highest degree of animal intelligence in that kingdom. And the two examples given are the elephant and the dolphin. Now, just to give you an example of the intelligence of the elephant and why it's so complex and also why it's not quite human is, if you have an elephant, of course, you know it can be highly trained and it never forgets. Its previous experience with a human being, tremendous capacity for memory, but that memory is intuitive or instinctive. It's not selective, and by that we mean you have this 2 or 3 ton elephant, but at one point it was a little baby elephant, and the way they train these elephants is when they're very young, they wrap a string around the elephant's leg and tie it to a tree. Now at that point, the elephant is not strong enough to break away from that string. So impressed in its memory is the idea that this string can hold their leg and they cannot move. But this is when they're very small, they've just been born. As the elephant grows and it's so many feet tall and it's so many tons, they tie the same string around the leg and attach it to the tree, and still the elephant won't move. It could pull the tree down, but in the memory is caught that idea that they can't break loose. So once again, you see the ability for tremendous intelligence, but not the self-conscious reasoning that can figure things out. Just a little shy of what it needs to make the change. So, but the point was, who are the saviors of humanity? Well, in this sense, none of those saviors come forth as wanting to save us. They don't come forth and say, you depend on me for your salvation. They come forth and say, know ye not that ye are gods and the kingdom of God is within you, or thou art Buddha, or Krishna saying that thou have passed through many births, I know of mine and thou knowest not of yours. Both I and thou and all the princes of the earth have ever, forever, hereafter never cease to be. They constantly point to the godlike nature within the human being, and they are to the saviors to the extent they try to bring out, to instruct, to inspire by their teachings and by the example of their lives. In other words, they just as we at one point were lit up to self-conscious awareness, these saviors try to light up in ourselves the next stage of self-conscious evolution, which goes from individual self-consciousness to universal self-consciousness, meaning that we no longer think of ourselves as separate self-conscious beings, but think of ourselves as self-conscious beings that are one and part of the whole and interconnected with all of life. We no longer think of ourselves as drops, but as drops within and indistinguishable from the ocean of life. And that's their role as saviors. Yes?
I just wanted to look at the comparison you spoke about the elephant. But it's used so much in the human. You know, I mean, every time you turn, you gotta look at so many things and how we're actually controlled with false things that we don't have power to do this. We can't do this. We constantly, you know, inundated with this, and we grow up to think that, you know, we actually can't do things that we can do. We think that we're weak.
Yes.
You know, we think that we have no. We think that we can't create.
Yes.
You know, and we do it every day. But you know, a lot of times, from that input that we get, we're constantly telling ourselves that we can't do something, so we're creating.
Yes. That's a very good point, and we the analogy here is this, that we carry that over from our earliest childhood when we are the most impressionable, just like the elephant, when the strings that bind us are not so much physical strings, but what our parents teach us, what society teaches, what we hear on TV, what we listen to on our iPads, what we read in books. These impress our nature. And as you say, they act automatically in our nature. But psychologists know, and anyone work teacher knows, that their power comes from the fact we do not exercise our self-conscious awareness of them. As soon as we make the attempt to journal, to write down, to keep track of our cravings, for example, our ideas, our moods, as soon as we begin to study them, they lose their power over us. The first step to beginning to change your nature is to become aware of it. So we may go along for years and years and think, I'm not getting anywhere, I'm just learning more and more of my problems. Well, that's terrific. Before they were there and they were influencing you, but you did not know. Now you know, and by beginning to know, then you can make progress. Why else would Jesus say, you know, cast the beam out of your own eye before you try it? Okay, the mote and the beam analogy. And let him who was out sin cast the first stone. I mean, those beings, they've been all through all the human condition. They know that the potentiality for the lowest human behavior is within them as well. They've only made the effort to understand it and subdue it and transform it into a higher degree of service for others. So it's the source of their compassion. Yes?
This has been a perfect illustration of something that's often said during the third fundamental. The idea of reaching perfection is that there is no final place that you reach, that it's a constant struggle. Regardless of where you're at, there's always more perfection ahead of you. We see this now in thanks to this teaching from the animal, from the mineral to the vegetable to the animal. And then in our own evolution, each day we are seeing something new that we can do and accomplish. So
yes.
Very interesting.
So evolution is always, in that sense, a struggle, because that struggle is evidence for the need of the further development of our powers. But as we make that struggle, we become stronger to take on new evolutionary challenges. So next week we will continue this challenge. of trying to understand the individuality and the personality. Our meeting is adjourned.